Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 319 on Friday, September 12th, 2014. Greetings from Cambridge, Massachusetts, where we are settling into city life after a good long stay in Maine this summer. If I had been back in Denver, I could have driven 25 minutes to interview this week's interview guest in person, since Jim Duncan's office at the Colorado Library Consortium is in Centennial, just south of Denver. Instead, we collapsed the distance with Skype in order to provide an update on the challenges and opportunities that public libraries are facing in the digital age.
Now the game changes. We could go back as a group of libraries, hundreds of libraries across Colorado, to a Big Five publisher and say, we're ready to buy your content directly, and here's the way it looks.
In news, I will have some good news about the reading habits of the millennial generation, and as the month when new Kindles are usually announced unfolds, I will dust off an old rumor about what an updated Kindle e-reader might actually look like. I'll also let you know if I and the other approximately 26 people who bought Fire phones will get a rebate now that the price has dropped from $199 to 99 cents. I'll also have a couple of tech tips for you and a suggested article to read by Clay Shirky about the Amazon versus Hachette. He calls it a skirmish, and it's a very interesting piece I'll tell you about. First up in news, since there really isn't any news yet about new Kindles that might be coming this fall, I thought I would take you back to last year's rumor reported in TechCrunch on November 24th that a new Kindle codenamed Ice Wine was set to launch, quote, in early Q2, which would have been April or maybe May. Well, that one turned out to have the timing wrong, we now know, 4 months later. But what about the description of this tantalizingly named Ice Wine Kindle? Matthew Panzerino of TechCrunch wrote that the marquee feature of the new device is a high-resolution 300 ppi screen that will bring the Kindle displays, which are now at 212 ppi, back into the lead in technical specs compared with the Kobo Aura HD, which has 265 ppi. Now, I very much doubt that you or I would be able to detect the differences in screen resolution at these numbers, but there may be some advantage in having the best specs to talk about. Panzerino also reported seeing a prototype of the Ice Wine Kindle that featured a front screen flush with the edges rather than recessed. It's said to be lighter than current models, despite having a matte glass finish of some sort instead of plastic. There will also be, if not exactly, buttons for next and previous page, as you may remember from pre-touch versions of the Kindle, but some kind of a squeezable button that, in TechCrunch's words, give off haptic feedback when activated. He continued, theoretically, this should allow you to change pages without having to awkwardly reach over your thumb to tap the next page zone on the Paperwhite screen, and making the button squeezable keeps the sleek lines of the Paperwhite's margins. Now, TechCrunch also reported the new Kindle will have an ambient light sensor that will take readings of the light in the room and adjust the screen brightness to compensate automatically instead of requiring the use of a slider on the home controls bar. I don't see this as a huge leap forward in reading, actually, but I guess it's kind of cool to have your Kindle figuring out how light it is in the room, so that might be nice. A feature that might make a big difference is the report that Ice Wine will have new typography with a custom-built font that's supposedly great for reading. Now, I'm a big fan of the standard, I don't know how you say this, C-A-E-C-I-L-I-A, Chisilla? I think it's Italian. Anyway, that's the font that I think it's been on every Kindle since the original, but I'm open to falling in love with a new font, if there is one, and pretty quickly forgetting it because I don't really concentrate much on the fonts as I'm reading. There was no mention of a price point for Ice Wine in the TechCrunch story 9 months ago, and there was also no report on new Kindle Fire models. So we'll see. As I've said before in interviews with Russ Grandinetti and Dave Limp, this year, two of Amazon's senior vice presidents in charge of the Kindle. Each one of them nearly came out of his chair wanting to assure me that the company is very committed to dedicated e-readers, as if they wish they could tell me something specific. So I will be very surprised if a refresh is not in the cards sometime before Christmas. In reply to my request last week for Kindle wish list ideas, Garrett Riley emailed me this week, quote, "I wish the new Paperwhite was thinner, lighter, and shrink the bezel and puts the sleep-wake button somewhere other than on the bottom." Now, that last item actually was also mentioned by the TechCrunch piece, which said Ice Wine will feature a rear power button that looks similar to that of the Fire tablets. I agree that would be a nice ergonomic improvement. If you hear any rumors that sound credible to you, I hope you'll pass them along to me at podchronicles@gmail.com. And as always, stay tuned to the Kindle Chronicles for the full story if and when it's released. And I'll also be sending out an alert to the Kindle Chronicles free newsletter list as soon as I find something out. So if you're not on that list, it'd be a good time to go to thekindlechronicles.com, put in your first and last name and email address, and then you'll join. I think there are about 250 people now that get a special news alerts to me from me when I receive them, kind of out of sync with the weekly podcast. And there's also a link whenever the podcast goes up immediately. So that's I try to keep that a useful list, a bit of news for you, and I'd love to have more people signed up for it. So hope you'll take a look at it. Next up in news is a fire sale. How can you not go for that one when estimates of sales of the Fire Phone have total sales so far in the 35,000 range? By comparison, Apple is selling more than 2 million iPhones a week, and that's before crazy Apple fanatics start lining up in the wee hours of September 19th to buy the new iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. As you know by now, I won't be joining this time unless I wake up at 2 a.m. here in Cambridge and sleepwalk my way from deep habit to the Cambridge Side Galleria Mall store, where I was first in line for the original iPhone and several of the other models. I did buy a Fire Phone. When I saw this news of 99 cents as the new price, I thought it was a typo when it came in as an email from Amazon corporate PR. And it also came the day before Tim Cook, the Apple CEO, announced the new iPhones and the Apple Watch. Timing is everything. James McQuivey added to a tweet that I had posted about this. He was probably smiling with it. And David Streitfeld, the New York Times reporter whose coverage of Amazon generally makes me break out in hives, surprised me by writing what I thought was a pretty objective story about the $198 price drop on the Fire. He made me smile with his suggestion in the lead of his story that if all 60,000 people who had submitted requests to attend the Amazon June press conference in Seattle had actually bought a Fire Phone, Amazon would be in a better position than it appears to be now in terms of sales. Now, we don't know what these sales are. They were backing out some wireless usage numbers and coming up with a very low number. But I have to say, everything I'm sort of perceiving is that the sales have been very small. Streitfeld then wrote a sentence that I bet someone in Seattle has clipped to save in hopes that 5 years from now it will appear on a screen at an Amazon press conference as an example of clueless and discredited early scoffers just before another slide comes on the screen showing a hockey stick graph of Fire Phone 4's amazing sales growth. Streitfeld wrote, "The Amazon Fire is threatening to become the Amazon Fizzle." Well, we'll see. I contacted Mayday as soon as I saw word of the 99-cent price and was told that there would not be rebates for us early adopters, sadly. But thanks to a mention of rebates in the Streitfeld article, I tried it Mayday again today, and a tech advisor named Brett told me that, yes, there is a full rebate, and the money will be credited to my credit card within 3 to 5 business days. So that'll about pay for my New York Times premium subscription for another 5 months, so I'm a happy customer, and I'm grateful to David Streitfeld for including that in his story. I also liked his quoting of James McQuivey in the article. He's got a quote from McQuivey that says, "Amazon is a company that prizes innovation and experimentation, and it can handle one or two major flops a year without too much trouble." And then a Piper Jaffray analyst was quoted as saying, "I would never rule out Jeff Bezos and his determination. I don't think they're done in phones by any stretch of the imagination, but it will be a long road." None of this really bothers me much, though I am expecting a difficult decision early next year when the Apple Watch arrives, and of course I won't be able to run it with my Fire phone. But meanwhile, I'm getting more and more attached to the Fire. And to explain why, I'm going to just pass along what struck me as a nearly magical example of the Firefly capability, which makes me imagine that this will eventually turn into the killer app for the phone, even more than the dynamic perspective 3D tricks that it can perform. I was at a gathering that my sister organized at the Ocean Park Main Library a couple of weeks ago. We met in a room that was used for children's story hours, and she had happened on a wonderful book about Maine titled Time of Wonder by Robert McCloskey, who also wrote the classic children's book Make Way for Ducklings, set here in Boston. I knew my sister had fallen in love with the book, and I imagined how much fun it would be to get a copy for her. So I clicked and held the Firefly button on the side of the Fire phone for a couple of seconds, aimed the camera at the cover of the book, and watched the little Firefly dots or lights circle the image until the book was recognized. At that point, an image of the cover appeared on the Fire along with a highlighted Shop Amazon link. When I tapped on it, I brought up the book in hardcover format, and on the spot, before the meeting started, I tapped in an order for a used copy costing $3.81 plus shipping from a third-party supplier named All In Books. It won't arrive at her home for a while, but that's okay when it does. She's going to remember her joy of finding that book at the Ocean Park Library, and her big brother will be very happy to have made a little magic happen with the help of Firefly on the Fire phone. Hey, you know, I could have found that book with a few more clicks on an iPhone, of course, but the genius of Amazon is that they realize how much fun it is when technological friction disappears and you have little fireflies surrounding something that you've spotted in the real world and maybe want to buy or learn more about. It was really a bit eerie to have a book published in 1968 that was really frayed in the book that she was holding. That's the year I graduated from high school, and it shows up in the Fire within literally 2 seconds of aiming it at this book. Up pops the information and the place to buy it. So it leaves me wondering, what else does Firefly know? Finally in news, Pew Internet Research is out with an encouraging report on the reading habits of the millennial generation. These are readers of ages 16 to 29, and it turns out they read even more than we oldsters do. This study was geared toward use of public libraries, about which you'll hear more from Jim Duncan. It found that though millennials' lives are full of technology, they are more likely than their elders to say that important information is not available on the internet. A more sobering finding for libraries had it that though millennials are as likely as older people to have used a library in the past 12 months and more likely to have used a library website, only 19% of them say their library's closing would have a major impact on them and their families, compared with 32% of older adults. I will have a link to a summary report from Pew and coverage in Digital Book World at thekindlechronicles.com. For the first tech tip, I got an interesting question from listener Paul Atkins about organizing collections. He wrote, "Hi Len, listening to your podcast now with the section on collections, my desire is to organize my collections on my Mac and have them show up on my Kindle. To do them on the Paperwhite is cumbersome and not very efficient, so I imagine organizing all my books on the webpage and then magically appearing on the Paperwhite." He thinks that would be cool, and I agree. I checked with Stephen, a Mayday support tech, today, who spent about 5 minutes checking this out. He came back confirming my own exploration of the Kindle for Mac app, which I thought might be able to do this, and it showed that collections do appear on that app, but they are just for content on this particular machine. They don't propagate from my cloud collections to the Kindle for Mac application, and I can't get things, the changes to collections to show up through cloud collections to my other devices. There is an import collection choice on the Kindle for Mac app, and when I set up a new collection on the Mac, it showed me the name of my Paperwhite, which I named Paul Chowder in homage to Nicholson Baker's novel Traveling Sprinkler. When I clicked to import the collections on that Paperwhite, only three showed up, not the six collections that actually currently reside on the Paperwhite and also on my other cloud-connected devices. So that's some kind of an older set of collections that used to show up in the archives, and it's not much use anymore. I think Paul's suggestion is a good one, and that it would be very handy to be able to add, delete, or rename collections from a computer, either by connecting with cloud collections or perhaps through a new capability of the Manage Your Content and Devices page, formerly known as Manage Your Kindle. Speaking of the Manage Your Content and Devices page, I want to pass along sort of a Amazon Easter egg that I stumbled across when I was working on this. When that very useful tool for organizing your Kindle content used to be called Manage Your Kindle, you could get to it directly by entering amazon.com/MYK, which stands for Manage Your Kindle, in your browser. So on a hunch, I tried to enter the equivalent shortcut for Manage Your Content and Devices. You've got it, M-Y-C-D, after Amazon.com. And when I entered Amazon.com/MYCD, sure enough, it went directly to the page. These guys don't miss much, do they? Jim Duncan has been in the library industry for more than 20 years, beginning with an academic library position in Philadelphia and moving from there to a decade of work at the University of Iowa, where he led an advanced educational technology facility. I spoke with Jim by Skype on Wednesday, September 10th, 2014, reaching him at his office just south of Denver. He had a very nice lapel microphone during the interview, which would have made for great audio for this conversation, better than average, if I hadn't made a rookie error on my end and left my audio input set to the display monitor instead of my nice high-quality Yeti microphone that I was uselessly speaking into even though it wasn't the input. Oh well. I hope you will still enjoy this update on the cutting edge in library innovation. Let's pick up the conversation at the point where Jim Duncan describes Information Commons at the University of Iowa, where he was director before moving to Colorado.
This is the kind of place where libraries were starting to dream about doing things beyond what they had been, moving well beyond storehouses of books into electronic delivery of content. The particular facility that I directed ended up being really entrepreneurial. I founded a production services operation where we were using the library as a place to publish content accessible on things like handheld devices, you know, the early Palm Pilots of the days, producing databases and websites and full textbooks electronically.
What period of time was this?
This would have been 96 through 2006.
Hmm.
I was there.
So you were steeped in the future before it arrived.
Right. And we were actually charging back for those services. So it was a revenue-generating operation for the library, largely directed at academic departments. But the thing is they were going outside the university anyway to get those kind of production services. And why not undercut the commercial competition outside and beyond the university by doing things internally and at the same professional level?
Then what brought you to Colorado?
I was really interested in extending my playground to become bigger. So I arrived in Colorado to work at the State Library, which is part of state government, which some, you know, have mixed feelings about, let's say. But the reality is the State Library is an entity that provides phenomenal services to hundreds of libraries across Colorado and really is relied upon for some key infrastructure services, the kinds of things that individual libraries don't really roll out on their own, that really require a network, require libraries working together.
That's how you ended up at the Colorado Library Consortium?
Correct.
And what does the consortium do?
We provide services and resources to just about every library in the state. It's more than 400 libraries directly receiving services from us. It's a whole mixed bag of resources and services.
I think with that background, it makes me want to ask you sort of the big picture of libraries. I think public libraries came into being sort of in the early 20th century. And do you think we still need libraries in the digital age?
I'm always thrown by that question, and here's why. It just is kind of ludicrous when it comes down to it. If you say everything can be made available online, then you're missing out on a huge experience that's available to you from the public library.
And this would be related to the benefits of actually going to a place that kind of convenes people interested in books. Is that sort of the nature of what you can't get on at the internet?
It's the community living room, really. It's the place where you can engage with other people. You can access programs. You can go to reflect. I mean, think about where is there in this world at this point any other place where you can simply go and be in a neutral space and pursue whatever your dream is, whether it's reading, whether it's entertainment, whether it's interacting with other people, it's participating in a community program. In more recently, we're seeing things like the maker space, the maker revolution, where people are getting together and building things and learning how to build things. And you don't do that so well in a Starbucks, I'd say.
When you think about the start of the public library movement, do you see a different purpose then for libraries than the purpose of a library now, or is it kind of a continuum that's evolved as the technology and the society has evolved?
I think that's a great point. It's the latter. It really is a continuum. And I think it depends on the needs of the community. Not every library is the same. These are not cookie cutter operations. They're not retail outlets for some conglomerate. They reflect the identity and the uniqueness of every community. So in one community, let's say in northeastern Colorado, it may be that there's a demand for more resources and programs and services surrounding auto repair. I'm just picking a topic. You know, there happens to be a good community of shade tree mechanics, right? And who knows what the library can do to facilitate programs and services and other things related to that topic. In another community, it could be, in Colorado, it could be skiing, it could be hiking, it could be local business development. It could be that in southeastern Colorado, there's a community where they're really ambitious about bringing in new businesses, and they understand the power of the internet and home-based businesses and startups and the understanding that you can do it anywhere geographically. But there still, in my view, needs to be a brick-and-mortar place that is grounding and helps facilitate the launch of all these kinds of services, whether they are physical and in person or they're virtual. The website for the library is nothing more than a virtual branch, and it can replicate some of the things that are going on in the brick and mortar. It can't replicate some things. I mean, I dare you to find a web-based story time that's as engaging for a new mother and her baby who's going in and taking advantage of early literacy opportunities there. You won't find that on the web, in my view.
That's kind of a compelling vision that explains why I think that there was a Pew study a while back that showed people love their libraries. I mean, and I think it is that sense of being connected. But as you ground the purpose of a library there, what are the particular challenges that you're facing now with ebook technology and digital content that is really a challenge to maintaining that purpose in the community into the future.
Well, I think you're probably aware, as many of your listeners are, of some of the challenges. We're really in an early churn mode in this evolving marketplace. You have publishers trying to figure out how to get their great content in the hands of readers and to increase the number of readers who are consuming their content. You've got sort of middle market companies that are trying to facilitate the delivery of content. That's companies like Amazon and Overdrive and 3M and Baker & Taylor and others standing up platforms for delivery of e-content that way. And then you've got a whole diverse landscape of end user consumers. And those are John Smith in his house, Harry Smith in his office, and Sally Smith in her home. And then you've got the libraries playing a role in this, certainly. So for me, and I think for most folks who are in this industry, in the library side, it's figuring out where can we insert ourselves appropriately into that spectrum, that whole flow, and bring value to our communities. One way we've done that traditionally is by leveraging the cooperative purchase model, where we can buy a lot of content at a cost that is affordable, that brings profit to the publishers or to the vendors, and that returns value to the consumers where they can't afford to buy every single one of those given titles. And so we've done that for many, many decades, obviously, in the print realm. So how does that transition to the electronic realm? And that's more difficult. And part of it is because those fulfillment chains aren't really established. They're limited, and there's not good competition. So right now, you have this struggle between an individual patron who says, hey, I can just go on Amazon and I can buy it now. And there's that immediate gratification and satisfaction. That's great. And I don't think we want to challenge that. But what we want to do is provide an alternative for patrons who say, I can't afford 100 books this year. Maybe I buy 5 books through Amazon this year and I check out 95 books from the library. But the library can't actually get that content because either publishers won't sell directly, there aren't the platforms to take that content and deliver it to patrons, or publishers license or sell to middle market companies who then market up to such an extent that it's not affordable for libraries. Nobody wins in that model except for the libraries that have just enough scratch to put together to buy a limited number of titles. But the dream I think everyone has is get an explosion of great electronic content into the hands of a hungry populace and do it in a way that everybody comes out winning. I still have hope that we can achieve that. So we're working on some things here to address some of those challenges.
It strikes me that Overdrive is probably the main player in that intermediary between the publishers and the libraries, and that they have probably spent millions of dollars creating the platform that is in use. And as a result of it, it's very easy to, you know, I just tried out the Denver Library and I got an Updike novel that I borrowed. And it was, I don't know, 4 taps of my finger from finding it to getting it onto my various devices. And to replicate that ease of use for the reader from kind of a consortium of libraries, even if it could somehow be a national consortium of libraries, it strikes me as almost quixotic that you could actually do something that from the reader's point of view would ever come close to the frictionless methods that Overdrive, and I assume 3M's got a similar system, have got in place now.
How about this? You as a patron are searching in your library's catalog, you find a book title and it's available electronically, and you can click it right there within the catalog and check it out right there. that is an example of something that we're proving out technically with our Evoke project right now. I think that it is not unreasonable to set the bar that high and expect that end user experience be delivered to patrons of libraries and even further, consumers of commercial services. Right now, what we have in place is exactly what you've described, where many libraries, you'll find maybe a lead or a link to an ebook title in the catalog, and then you click off to a separate silo, and there's where your interaction takes place, where your circulation activity, as we say in this industry, your checkout or check-in activity takes place. But is that, are we satisfied with that? Is that sufficient? And I think you know librarians well enough to know we are always gunning for and pushing for better experiences for our patrons.
So then I guess it comes down to the content, because some of the experiments like Douglas County and what you're doing statewide with Evoke, you have signed up some mid-list publishers and people that have agreed to the terms. But has there been any progress in the last year or two on the availability and the prices of books that are coming from the big five, which are sort of, you know, the big books that a lot of people want to read?
No, not with regard to the work being done here in Colorado, but it's not unexpected, because when I've talked with my colleagues at Douglas County Libraries, they've said, we've had very good and frank conversations with representatives from the big five, and they have said, sure, we're interested in being able to sell directly to libraries and perhaps net a greater amount from those sales than when we work through a middle market kind of provider. But their challenge from the publisher side is they don't want to sell to just one library. There's a challenge of scale and scalability here. So the fundamental proof of concept model that Douglas County rolled out was, A, would publishers be willing to sell directly to libraries? And many said, yeah, we'll experiment with you on this. We like what you're doing here. The big five saying, we're not really interested, no matter how much publicity you've gotten out of this, in selling just direct to you. But come back to us if you had something where we could sell to hundreds of you, right? Enter Evoke, which is the current project we're working on. Douglas County Libraries is the entity that's working on the fundamental technical underpinnings. My organization is involved in trying to forecast, what does the financial model look like? What does the sustainability look like? How do we scale this so that now the game changes? We could go back as a group of libraries, hundreds of libraries across Colorado, to a big five publisher and say, we're ready to buy your content directly, and here's the way it looks. You make your content exposed and available in our marketplace. The collection development librarians, the people who make those decisions on purchasing, go into the marketplace and click, click, click. They can check all the various titles they want to purchase, the number of copies. You know, if they want that bestseller and they know there's going to be a queue of 100 people waiting for that ebook title, they're going to want to buy the same volume of copies as they've been doing on the print side. And so they set that and click purchase. The magic happens. The invoices take place. And there you have suddenly content available to the library in that platform. The next side of the spectrum, if you will, is how do you make that content deliverable in an elegant way to the end user patron? So the concept behind the Evoke platform is that the content's there, but it's exposed through what they call APIs. An API is a piece of code that allows one system to talk or integrate with another system. And that's the magic that would allow for a Denver Public Library or a Douglas County Library or one of the libraries from the Marmot Library Network on our Western Slope to deliver that record in the catalog for that Updike novel that you wanted to check out. And you click check out, it asks you for your library card, your PIN, and then away you go. you haven't had to jump off to another platform. You haven't had to even jump back to the Evoke platform, because the Evoke platform is talking under the surface with the library catalog at that deeper level, that integrated API level. And that's really the fulfillment of that quality end user experience.
Now, if I have a Kindle, I'm not going to be able to participate in that because of the DRM, the digital rights management protections that Amazon usually has to build in because the publishers demand it. If it's a Tor book, there's no digital rights management, so you know, you could imagine getting a Kindle version of a publisher like Tor without running into that barrier. But if you succeeded in getting a lot of Big Five titles in your system, Evoke in Colorado, would there be a path for me to read it on a Kindle?
That would be a good question for the Douglas County folks. And I'm not a Kindle user, otherwise I could probably answer that right off the top. What I can assure you and folks is that the Evoke platform isn't about taking a single copy of a book and distributing it to anybody as many times. DRM is intact, so it can deliver DRM and non-DRM content. EPUB, PDF, deeper than that, I'm not the guy you should be talking to in terms of the sort of end user fulfillment experience at that level.
Yeah, I think that probably where it would, the problem would be, and maybe you could work with Amazon, because Amazon worked with Overdrive, and you just have to get some kind of an arrangement with them that they would make their DRM process available to you, similar to the Adobe process that's used on all of the EPUB books.
Right.
And as I understand it, the project that you have there is being funded under a grant of a little over $200,000 to set up sort of a prototype. Have you got an opening day marked on your calendar when people in Colorado are going to actually be able to see what you've assembled under the prototype?
Yes, the alpha level technology aspects are going to be completed at the end of this month. Then we're going to have a several month process of continued testing beyond the end of the grant period. But we're obviously committed to this for an extended period to figure out how can we continue to scale and grow this. I would say January timeframe is when we're going to start to see key selected library partners really testing this. Notable partners are the Marmot Library Network on the Western Slope, and now with some members here on the Front Range of Colorado. The AspenCat Library Group, which is actually a union catalog setup that we manage. This is small rural libraries, more than 61 of them across the state, in the tiniest of places, the most rural and remote of places. They're going to be able to start testing and exploring this. The opening day collection is pretty small. We only invested about $11,000 in content costs. That's for a little over 1,100 titles. But the idea behind this has been proof of concept, a period of time spent building out the financial model, because if we couldn't prove out it could be done technically, there was no reason to move further. But with the successes we've already had, it's clear we need to be putting some serious deliberation into what is the financial model and the sustainable model look like here. Is this a membership model where libraries elect to participate in the platform? What sorts of things might be involved in terms of individual library collections versus consortial collections? There's all kinds of interesting opportunities there, both for better exposure of content to patrons across multiple libraries, as well as for some cost savings. The bottom line still is we want to provide a great alternative venue for publishers to sell their content, make profit, and enable libraries to deliver content that they know their patrons are chomping to get at.
Connecticut recently, the state legislature there passed something to set up a statewide ebook content delivery system for that state. Are you working closely with them, or what other sorts of national partners are you working with that are pursuing a similar goal?
We are visiting with, talking with, discussing what we're doing in Colorado with other similar projects going on in other parts of the country. One might say, well, why doesn't somebody just do this centrally at the federal level, or sort of herd all the cats together? They've got to have the same kind of needs and challenges. So aren't you reinventing the wheel here? I think we're so early in the industry, this part of the industry, it doesn't, in my view, make sense to unify quite yet. I think we're going to have more creative output from diverse communities and diverse parts of the state, diverse parts of the country, excuse me, right now. That's going to, I think, inform a more robust, ultimate, universalized solution. So we're not against talking and even sharing much of what we're doing. In fact, that's our intention, to fully transparently share exactly what we've done, how we've done it, what it's cost to do that, and to have those discussions with other states to figure out, okay, what have you been doing? Now let's compare some notes. Now that we both have experience with this, let's figure out how we can do something together.
I can imagine that some of this feels like beating your head against a wall. How optimistic are you that 5, 10, 50 years from now, you're going to look back and see that you really were working on something that evolved into a pretty exciting future for libraries?
Well, let's say it doesn't evolve into something, and there's always that possibility. All of this fails, and we end up having a handful of commercial vendors, and that's the only channels through which libraries are able to purchase or license, if you will, in many cases, electronic content for delivery to their patrons. In my view, the fight that we're conducting is still worth it because it is having ripple effects. This is just my opinion, but I look at what Douglas County has been doing for the last 3 years and their move to partner with Smashwords. So Douglas County partnered with Smashwords, looked at the highest selling titles there and purchased those. It wasn't too long, I thought, that I saw Overdrive saying, hey, we should look at this secondary market. We hadn't considered the whole self-published market. And you start to see commercial entities like that mimicking in some ways. So in my view, that was already a success, an outcome from Douglas's experimentation, because it's sending a message to commercial entities, and many of these are partners with us. And so I don't want you to get the sense that I'm against Overdrive or against 3M. We're all part of this evolving ecosystem. And I think it behooves all of us to continue to experiment and evolve in our various channels until ultimately we are achieving what we all dream of, which is great profit for publishers, great profit for commercial entities, good cost savings for libraries, and a phenomenal return on investment for your end user patrons.
In content, I want to alert you to a powerful essay by Clay Shirky that I just came across today via David Vandegrift's Passive Voice blog. It's titled Amazon Publishers and Readers, and you'll find it at medium.com, and I'll have the link in the show notes. Shirky's an original thinker. He teaches at NYU. He's written a couple of really seminal books about the internet, and he weighs in on a couple of folks that have come to the publisher's defense attacking Amazon, George Packer, who was on the show a while back, and Steve Call, who wrote an anti-Bezos piece in the New York Review of Books. He really goes to the nub of the issue, how this battle is more about cultural prestige bestowed by the current publishing system, and how Amazon's opening of the publishing system to all comers eliminates it. He states that he's a member of the class that benefits from the current system, and he writes, the reason my fellow elites hate the people who run Amazon is that they refuse to flatter our pretensions. In my tribe, this is a crime more heinous even than eating one's salad with one's dessert fork. That's it for this week. Next week, I will be back on the road to a meeting in New York City, followed by a flight to Denver to join Darlene in Casper, Wyoming. My friend and eBooks for Troops helper Tom Atkinson's son, Jeff, passed away this week after a long battle with cancer, so we will be there for the funeral on Friday. Jeff was a Casper fireman, a devoted husband, father to two young boys, and a man of infectious kindness and good humor. He passed away on September 11th at the age of 48. In lieu of flowers, Jeff requested donations to the Atkinson Scholarship Fund at U.S. Bank in Casper. This is Len Edgerly in Cambridge, Massachusetts for the Kindle Chronicles. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast.